Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. Kirk Heinze hosts today's program.
In recognition of the 45th anniversary of Earth Day, we convened a panel of three prominent environmental advocates to reflect on the significance of Earth Day and to discuss progress made since that very first Earth Day in 1970. We'll also learn what they think are the most immediate challenges facing the Great Lakes region, and what each of us can do to help meet those challenges.
People need to get scared about climate change.
It's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, and we get started at 4:06. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Green, green, it's green, they say, on the far side of the hill. Green, green, I'm going away to where the grass is greener still.
Well, 46 years ago, on April 22nd, 1970, we celebrated the inaugural Earth Day. And the New York Times cover read, and I quote, "Millions join Earth Day observances across the nation." But then, you know, grave national concerns over issues like Vietnam, urban poverty, civil rights quickly regained the media center stage. Over four decades later, Earth Day is an international phenomenon, and global sustainability issues are constantly in the news. With us to talk about the significance of Earth Day and other key environmental issues is our own inaugural Earth Day panel, three individuals who have devoted much of their lives to the preservation and enhancement of our environment. Our guests are Jack Schmidt, the Deputy Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, which is a nonpartisan political voice for protecting Michigan's environment. We have James Clift, who's the Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council, a coalition of over 70 organizations across Michigan that focus on a number of key areas ranging from clean energy to environmental justice. And George Hartwell, former three-term mayor of Grand Rapids, which under his watch has been recognized nationally and internationally as one of the world's greenest cities. Gentlemen, welcome to the inaugural Earth Day panel.
Well, great. Thank you, Kirk, for putting this together. And I always look forward to spending time with you.
Let's start with this Earth Day issue, the significance of Earth Day. We're talking 45 years later. It was a big deal for a while back in 70. I remember, I'm going to date myself, I was a senior in college back then. I mean, that's gives you some idea of my pedigree. But, James, let's start with you. The significance to you of Earth Day, and what has it meant?
I mean, for us, it's a time for people to stop busy lives, rushing around, and think, you know, geez, how is my life, and how does that impact the environment? What am I doing? Am I doing my part to make this a better place to live for both myself, but my children and their children moving forward?
Jack?
Well, you know, coming at this from the kind of political vantage point, I can't help but reflect on the fact that Earth Day was really an important milestone for activism and engagement in the process and just awareness around the issues that and environmental challenges that face our planet, our country. And, you know, looking at the myriad of challenges we currently face, I think it's a really important time to reflect on a period in our country's history when there is an incredible amount of activism around these issues and just engagement around among the citizenry.
George?
You know, it's interesting to think about this past 45 years and because Kirk, you and I are of a similar vintage. The first Earth Day really came out of, and that our generation was the Rachel Carson generation. I think of our children now in their early 40s, and for them, you know, it was sort of the generation of recycling and William McDonough and Cradle to Cradle, and now my grandchildren are the children of Naomi Klein. This changes everything, and Elizabeth Colbert, the sixth extinction. Each generation has come up to their own Earth Days with a very different understanding and I think worldview and set of challenges in front of us.
Yeah, the evolution of Earth Day certainly comes into play here. One of the key themes this year is the planting of trees. 7.8 billion trees being planted over the next 5 years, one for every person on Earth. Reactions to that, some people think tree planting, really? Is that significant enough?
You know, I go back to what George just said there, in that when Earth Day was originally, I think we were looking at the United States. We were looking a little more locally. But now we're addressing issues which are global in nature. If you look at the climate change issue, it is global in nature and is going to take everybody working together to address it. So, and one of the ways to address it, of course, is planting trees, kind of offset that carbon footprint. So I think this is really a good way to do it moving forward, to really talk about those global issues where we both had to kind of excel as a country, provide leadership, but then work with others to effectuate the change we need.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it may seem insignificant. I remember being a child celebrating Earth Day by getting a free tree from my school to take home and plant. And while that may seem like a small step, to James's point, you know, when we're combating or looking at this truly global issue of climate change, one of the critical ways for impacting climate change is planting trees. They reduce carbon in the atmosphere.
Well, tree planting has both a practical application and a symbolic application in my mind. So, you know, practically, trees are cleansing the air. They're absorbing stormwater in cities. They're providing shelter and shade for animals and people. But symbolically, planting a tree says I'm making a commitment to a generation beyond that in which I'm living myself. This tree that I plant today, this little seedling, I won't see as a fully mature tree, but generations to come will. So it's an investment in a future.
What about some specific progress? How have we done since 1970, given where we were before then and where we are now?
I mean, I think one of the things we've looked at recently is that we're starting to get some good long-term studies that showed what is concerted action in a certain area get you. One recently I was reading about Southern California, improving the air quality in Southern California, and it's been improving for the last 20 years. But now they're tying it directly to the improved public health of the children growing up in Southern California. Reduction in the amount of diseases, it helps them with the learning. Again, this is an area where it shows that our collective action can make a difference and is making a difference long term. I know later we'll get into talking about kind of the Great Lakes, right, and the challenges we have there, but I think there really is some success stories out there about what our concerted action can do.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you look to some of the kind of monumental pieces of legislation that helped bring that about that came out of that kind of era that the first Earth Day happened, you know, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act. You know, this was a time that when the first Earth Day occurred, we've got the Cuyahoga River on fire. And I think even just from those really broad measurements, we've clearly made, a lot of progress since that time. You know, we've got a number of endangered species coming back. We've got cleaner water than we did. So I think that there have been a number of successes that we can point to this period of time and really this first Earth Day.
Something like 120 or 130 nations of the 196 that gathered in Paris last December have chosen this Earth Day as the official signing day in their own countries of the Paris Accords. When we think about how far science has advanced and our understanding of environmental challenges have advanced since 1970, we weren't talking about global warming in 1970. It wasn't part of the lexicon. Clearly today it's an environmental threat to the entire planet. I'm enormously thankful that the nations are now treating it seriously and coming together with around this Paris Climate Accords.
George Hartwell, you are at the Paris Climate Meetings, and there's going to be a big signing between the United States and China. But when you were there, and I know we've talked about this in a previous interview, but what was your sense of it upon leaving that summit?
Well, it was an enormous optimism, sense of optimism or hopefulness But that hopefulness for me was born by the fact that there were 600 mayors there from around the world, 37 from the U.S., and we had a day together in which we pledged ourselves to work at the local levels, irrespective of what national or international accords may exist and how well they're carried out. There are 600 mayors who left Paris in December representing a majority of the population of the world that went home to say, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it in our local communities.
Jack Schmidt, this accord that's going to be signed, or agreement between China and the United States, is this a formality? Is this window dressing, or are there some legs here?
There are definitely some legs, and I think both in the teeth of what's actually being signed and also from a symbolic standpoint. You've got the world's two largest economies making a public statement together that they're going to combat this challenge. And I think there are certainly teeth in what they're signing that we could probably spend more time than we've got discussing. But, you know, I think when I reflect on it, the symbolic significance of the fact that these two countries are joining together to combat this problem is really worth noting.
James Clift, there's been a lot of talk about China, India, and other parts of the world stepping up, the more developed countries. There's actually been a lot of talk about the United States stepping up a little bit more than we have. What's your sense of it?
I think the opportunity is there, but it is now time to act. I think, you know, you look at Michigan stepping up, and a lot of our energy regulation comes from the state level, but we stepped up in 2008. We're now using 30 million tons of coal less to generate our electricity than we did then. But we're at a turning point right now. That law has plateaued off, and we're waiting for our state legislature to take that next step. How do we reduce that next 30 million tons so that we're making our contribution to this larger effort? And I think that's the important part, is that the price of renewables at record low numbers, creating lots of clean energy jobs in economies around the world. The fact that China, they're saying China has peaked in its use of coal and is now coming back down, that's a big deal. But you got to be vigilant. You got to keep at it. You can't kind of rest on your laurels at this point.
One of the key indicators, if I could, Kirk, that I think we should look for is whether the developed nations begin funding the $100 billion a year suggested amount. It's not required, but it's suggested amount in the Paris Accords for allowing developing nations to leapfrog technologies and get to cleaner and greener technologies. We as the developed world have to step up, and to the extent that the U.S. and China and European nations begin doing that, I think we can have increased optimism of the success of the Paris Accords.
No, I think James had a really important point there in terms of our state and Michigan's role in this. You know, you look at kind of going back to the history that we talked about before of coming out of Earth Day, Michigan's Environmental Protection Act was really a model nationally for the National Environmental Protection Act during that time. And all the more reason that I think our state can and should be a leader when we're talking about these new challenges.
Well, nice segue back to Michigan, because there are several issues that are Michigan-specific and Great Lakes-specific that we're going to talk about. One question that I would like to ask, though, before we get there, we've got a presidential campaign going on now. There have been a lot of debates. I've been following the debates fairly closely. I've been struck, and this is me, and I'd like your reaction to this, I've been struck by the lack of attention by virtually all the candidates with respect to issues related to sustainability and environment. Your thoughts?
Well, when Martin O'Malley, Governor O'Malley of Maryland, was a viable candidate on the Democratic side, we heard more about this. It was a key issue for Governor O'Malley. I served with him on the White House Task Force of State and Local and Tribal Leaders on Climate Resilience, and I know how passionately he feels about these issues. When he left the stage and dropped out of the running, we've heard virtually nothing from either party.
Yeah, I think, you know, particularly when we're talking about the issue of climate change, that's very true. And it's been, you know, disappointing as a viewer of this race to kind of see that happen. I think, though, you know, looking at the broad spectrum of issues of clean water, of clean air, certainly the Flint water crisis has brought some attention to, you know, issues of clean water that we may. And you know, the fact that there is a presidential debate, a Democratic debate held in Flint, that issue was talked about at length by, I think, both candidates at that time. But, you know, certainly I think when we're talking about this climate change issue, there's been, you know, I think a lack of attention on both sides to it.
James Clift, what's your take on this? Am I imagining things, or do you have the same sense that, you know?
I think everybody is frustrated, especially watching the debates. You know, we know that future performance is best indicated by past performance. So I think the question that I always want to hear is, you know, what problems have you solved in the past and how did you go about doing it? You know, because that's what I want to know. Are you a problem solver who is looking for solutions, not, you know, pointing blame, pointing fingers? What are we going to do to move this country forward?
Well, of the candidates, I mean, you guys, some of these people have been on the stage for a long time. We know what the Obama administration, they've been hot and cold and more recently a little hotter on doing things related to global sustainability. I mean, of the candidates, is there anybody that has a platform on conservation, environmental issues that sort of stands out?
Well, I think that, you know, at this point, I will do my best to directly answer that question. You know, we're really focused so much on the state elections, truly, right? And,
right.
And particularly given, you know, we're an organization with a state focus, and we've got a really critical election here in Michigan at the state house level, that these issues definitely are on the ballot. I think in terms of the presidential race, at this point, you know, there have been some candidates. It depends on the issue, right? I mean, we've certainly heard on the Democratic side, if you look at their platforms, if you look at their websites, there are visions articulated for combating climate change for some of these issues. You know, you look at the Republican side, and a number of the candidates talk about and indicate an importance in protecting water resources. So I think it's so early, and this is such a different presidential race than we've seen in recent history. It'll be really interesting to see how it all plays out.
Let me take a modest exception to your characterization of the Obama administration, Kirk, because I think that in this second term, this president has been extraordinarily hot on this issue and on environmental issues, and especially on climate. He convened this panel of governors and mayors and tribal leaders with the express objective of giving him recommendations of actions he could take without having to go to Congress, executive order actions, and he has been aggressive in his use of executive orders. We had the unfortunate, I think, disastrous Supreme Court decision recently setting aside the Clean Power Plan until its appeals are exhausted. Notwithstanding, I think that this administration has been very strong in its second term on climate issues, and so to the extent that that Secretary Clinton aligns herself with this administration, and she clearly is doing that, I think she aligns herself with the with their environmental policies as well.
Do you think some of this is associated? I'd like to harken back to the 70s. People are so concerned about global terrorism, immigration reform, gun violence, things of that nature. Are folks sort of taking, and I'm talking about the public now, is it your perception that the public is sort of, maybe the environmental issues are a bit on the back burner, and that's one reason why we're not hearing so much about them in this campaign?
You know, I think you look at poll after poll, particularly in this region, that's actually not the case. You know, I mean, you look at issues like the Flint water crisis, you look at the fact that more and more people around the country are feeling directly the impact of climate change through more severe weather events, through, you know, we've had droughts here in Michigan that have impacted agriculture. And these are issues that rise, you know, particularly in this region, to the top of people's list of something that they care about. So I think it's maybe more an indication of, to James's point, some of the questions that they've been fielded at debates and debates that have really maybe sensationalized the race more than focusing on some of the issues.
Yeah.
I think that's the key point there, is you got to look the lens that you're getting this through, you know, and the media, they want to fight. They want, you know, confrontation. They want people on two sides. Where there is more agreement maybe on the environmental side about these people wanting to do something about it, therefore it doesn't make for good airtime. So therefore you hear a little less. But I think the public, when they want to elect candidates, we're going to deal with this. I'm polling that I'm seeing that say, you know, especially the independents, over 70% say they want their elected official to deal with the issue of climate change. That's a good number in my mind. That shows that we want to see a bipartisan effort to address this problem and do it soon.
At the same time, some of the issues that we're facing as a society are, feel like they have an urgency and an immediacy that climate change doesn't have. To an extent, here in the Midwest, we're buffered from a little bit of that. We're in a more temperate zone, and we're not experiencing the droughts, the hurricanes, the ocean rise, and so it's easier to sort of push that aside, I think, in people's minds, and focus on the things that are urgent. I don't have a job. I'm worried about terrorism. Those are scary things. People need to get scared about climate change, and then it rises. I think it rises to the top of the list.
Let's bring this back to Michigan. Several of you have alluded to some success we've had at Michigan. Certainly water was mentioned as an issue that has bipartisan support. We're doing a lot with water quality in the Great Lakes regions. What are some things that you guys feel particularly good about as you look across the Great Lakes region over the last few years?
You know, I look on the water side, and I think, you know, especially our control of point sources has been really good. But I think we also look at the Great Lakes and we say, geez, we don't see improvement happening there. You know, we're seeing these algae blooms, and that's really the non-point source side. That's the stormwater. And that does tie back to the climate change, that we're seeing more erratic weather. We're seeing bigger storms, lots of runoff during those spring months. I think that is going to be a challenging problem to address moving forward. And it takes a big collective effort among both the people within the state, the other eight Great Lakes states, the two Canadian provinces. It's going to take a collective effort to get around that one and see a turnaround in the actual quality of the Great Lakes. And as they warm a little bit, it gets a little challenging. So, again, I think we've done a good job on the point side. Non-point runoff is still a big issue to address moving forward.
One of those point sources that I think we've done particularly well on, and I guess I'm bragging on behalf of cities, is a combined sewer separation or basin and reservoir development in some of the larger cities, where we've been able to keep human waste out of the natural riverine system, and that clearly is making a big difference. Cities like, here we are in Lansing, doing an aggressive job right now of addressing their combined sewer problems. The city of Grand Rapids finished last year a 20-year separation initiative, $400 million. That's been a real plus. I think the other thing that we should point to is wetlands protection in the state, understanding of the importance of wetlands, and city after city adopting codes that protect wetland areas from filling and development.
I think, you know, one other that's been referenced a couple different times throughout this discussion, you look at Michigan's clean energy laws that were passed, you know, another bipartisan effort passed and signed by Governor Granholm at the time in 2008. And, $2.9 billion worth of economic activity, almost 78,000 jobs created here in the state. Renewables, wind and solar are now cheaper than coal. So really, by all measures, it's helped clean up our environment. It's helped spur economic growth, and it's helped reduce rates. It's been a huge success. And you know, to get into, I think, probably the next part of our conversation, it's a real challenge now that we need to define that policy moving into the future.
Gentlemen, we have spent a lot of time talking about national and global issues. We've talked about some of the success that we've seen in the Great Lakes region. What, from your perspective, are the things that we really need to work on in the next couple of years?
Well, let's first celebrate the fact that that we have seven coal-burning fire plants going offline this month, really, this month. And so that's huge in Michigan. I think where the work needs to take place now is at the is going to be at the local level on developing renewables, even as our big power utilities begin their own work of continue their work of developing renewables. We can do it at the local level too, and so cities need to be taking advantage of rooftop buildings for solar. City of Grand Rapids is putting up a 38-acre solar display on an abandoned dump site. Renewables are our future, and now is the time to be aggressive about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I also look to what we've seen play out with the Flint water crisis and learned as a result of that about some of the real infrastructure challenges facing our state. And you know, we tend to think of infrastructure just as a roads and bridges conversation. And I think, you know, we've clearly learned that I think, you know, it's beyond just roads and bridges. And there have been some great efforts to this end. You know, Mayor Hartwell was talking about some of the really significant progress that's been made in the City of Grand Rapids and efforts to kind of separate out water and sewage. But there's a big question here about how we address in some of our urban cores the pipelines and infrastructure that are delivering water to residences. And I think it's going to be a challenge that we need to really focus on over the next next number of years here.
Yeah, I think that engagement of the citizenry at the local level and both, you know, what's my city doing? So what's my city doing on safe drinking water? You know, do we know where all our lead service leads are? You know, do we have a long-term plan for replacing them? So those are issues that could be raised at city council. I think Flint has also kind of raised this issue of, is Michigan doing enough to support our cities? You know, are we doing enough to make sure that they've got the revenue they're going to need to address these infrastructure issues going forward? So I think it's very important to reignite this discussion of, cities are very important to the future of Michigan. We want robust, healthy cities. Therefore, what do we have to do both at the local level and the state level to make sure they're going to prosper going into the future?
The other thing we ought to put on this list of challenges, though, you referenced earlier, James, and that is the agricultural runoff that we're dealing with point source runoffs, but not doing a good enough job yet with ag runoff, and so we see city of Toledo with its entire water supply shut down because of the presence of blue-green algae in western Lake Erie. That's the result primarily of agricultural runoff. We got to address that problem. We got to address it legislatively, and we got to address it through agricultural policy.
And you mentioned earlier the wetlands, the importance of wetlands and floodplains. I think a lot of the solution there is going to be to have a lot of that runoff go into those natural floodplains, let it infiltrate into the groundwater, not run directly into our rivers and our lakes. But it is going to take, it's going to take work by the farmers. It's going to take work by everyone who lives in those communities to address those issues going forward.
Yeah, I think this is a really good issue, and you know, we also, you know, I don't want folks to think that it's just something that impacted Western Lake Erie and Toledo, which is, you know, maybe a really small percentage of our population here in the state was impacted, but you know, this is a problem that's plaguing Saginaw Bay. You go to the west side of the state, Lake Makatawa. You go Great Lakes Basin wide and look at Green Bay in Lake Michigan. So I think addressing these problems and you know, and a lot of the ways that James just referenced is probably one of the more critical water quality issues facing the Great Lakes region.
You've all mentioned in one form or another this matter of community responsibility and community engagement. For people listening to this program who sometimes may feel a little bit overwhelmed by all of these issues, in addition to some of those others that we've talked about earlier, what can someone listening to this program do as a first step or a first couple of steps to become part of the solution to some of these problems?
I'll start here. I guess in today's like electronic world, I think people sometimes forget about the power of a handwritten letter to their elected official. You know, if you get yourself and your neighbors together, they get 20 letters, handwritten letters from citizens. They realize that this is something they need to address. So that engagement and that one-on-one relationship that you can build with your elected officials can make a difference. It can matter, and it can change the way things are working.
Yeah, it was a great answer. It was going to be very close to what I was going to say, I was going to say it because we see it work. You know, I think it's easy to become disillusioned in the political process these days, to see the impact of money on elections and all these kind of stories play out that we hear about, but we actually see citizens get involved, and not in even necessarily huge thousands and thousands of numbers, but you and your neighbors get together and actually work on building a relationship with your elected official, which can start with a letter. It can continue with maybe attending a coffee hour or attending one of their town halls. And you become somebody who they know in the community as a resource on these issues. And they understand that these issues are important to somebody in their district and that they need to take action on them. So really do think that, a small step, writing a letter, attending a coffee hour, but more broadly speaking, building a relationship with your elected official and helping them understand that these issues are important to you is something any of us can do.
So when I talk to citizens about this and that question gets raised, I talk about working at the personal level, the political level, and the global level. These gentlemen have described well work at the political level that every citizen can and should do. Personally, there are so many things we can do in our own lifestyle to begin to make, albeit modest, improvements and changes. Everything from recycling to the kind of appliances that we purchase, to the making even investments in rooftop solar on our homes or geothermal for our homes. But then there's the global level, and that's the one that gets really difficult. How do I work at a global level on a global problem? Pope Francis' encyclical of last summer, the Laudato Si, was so powerful in making the connection between the plight of the planet and the plight of the poor, the issues, the social issues, and the environmental issues. And so I think we need to elevate our own consciousness and our own understanding about the way the climate is impacting communities of poverty around the world and in our own cities here in the U.S. When our hearts are warmed by that, I think it drives us, it compels us to act in different and better ways as people.
Well, you guys, you couldn't have helped me conclude the show. I have a quote here that I'd like to end with from Margaret Mead. It's a quote that you guys know well. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. It's been a delight talking to our expert panel here on Earth Day, our inaugural Earth Day panel on Greening the Great Lakes. Our guests have been George Hartwell, former mayor of the city of Grand Rapids, James Cliff, the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council, and Jack Schmidt, deputy director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Jack, James, and George, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
WKAR.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is my job. This is what I was trained to do. This is why I'm here. This is why I'm in Flint. This is why I went to MSU. This is me.
That's Mona Hannah Atisha, director of the Pediatric Residency Program at Hurley Medical Center in Flint, and Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Human Development at Michigan State University's College of Human Medicine. You know her as Dr. Mona from the Flint water crisis.
This is my commitment to my specialty, to my profession, to these children. If I am blessed with the privilege of being a physician, with the ability to use my voice, I will use it to care for our kids and to give them a brighter future.
Michigan State University and Hurley Children's Hospital have announced a new pediatric public health initiative to address the Flint community's population-wide lead exposure and help all Flint children grow up healthy and strong.
So the Michigan State University, Hurley Children's Hospital, pediatric public health initiative is our effort to flip the story. So we are trying to build a model public health program, a center of excellence to not see the consequences of lead exposure. So we have three specific arms of this initiative. The first is the assessment. So we're continuing our research to see how bad this exposure was. So we have lots of different research projects underway to determine the extent of this exposure. The second arm of the study is the monitoring. We are committed to doing the long-term follow-up with these children. We have a 20-year trajectory of what we're going to be doing. But the most important arm of this initiative is the third arm, and that's the interventions. And that is where we hope to flip the story. So never before in such a disaster have we been proactive. And we are trying to implement and advocate for the wraparound services that these kids need to limit the impact of this exposure. So things like early literacy programs, early intervention, home visiting programs, nutrition support, mental health access. These are evidence-based interventions that promote child development. And then we're going to assess this. We're going to assess this, and we're going to be a model for the nation. Look what happened to Flint. Look what this initiative did. These are our outcomes, and this is what you can do as well. The cool thing about this initiative, it's a collaboration with our community. It's also a collaboration with government. Our county health department, our state health department are part of this as well. These are things our kids needed anyways. We already had so many disparities. Our kids had every obstacle to success. We have limited food access. We have no full-service grocery stores in the city of Flint. We have one of the highest crime rates, one of the highest unemployment rates. Every day in my clinic, about 30% of my patients don't show up, not because they don't love their children, because they have every barrier to do what they need to do to make sure their children's lives are healthy. Then we, got this population-wide lead exposure. So we owe it to these children. They did absolutely nothing wrong besides live in a poor city that was almost bankrupt, that didn't treat its water. So we owe it to them to throw everything at them, but then to assess those interventions and to see how we can improve their health outcomes, how we can improve and minimize those disparities. Yeah. These are things that we should have been doing. These are our most vulnerable children to start with. They should have had all these wraparound services, access to education, safe places to play, great, nutrition access. They needed these things already.
Dr. Mona likes to say you can't have healthy kids without healthy adults.
So you cannot build healthy children without building that adult capacity, because a lot of it starts with parenting and having a supportive caregiver. We know in research, we know that when children are rattled with toxic stresses, when they live in poverty, when they have unstable home environments, when they have poor schools, when they're exposed to violence, we know that one thing that buffers them, that makes them resilient, is having a supportive caregiver in their lives, be it a parent, a coach, a pastor, somebody. So we have to build those supportive adults.
Dr. Hannah Atisha says she'll never grow weary of the microphone her international overnight notoriety has given her to continually highlight this humanitarian issue.
I will talk to anybody, anytime, anywhere. So this is a disaster. So what happened in Flint is a public health disaster, and everybody in the world needs to know about this. This is not a political issue. This is not a campaign issue. This is a humanitarian issue. If you are a human and you care about people and you care about children specifically, this should make you mad, and this should make you want to fight for a better tomorrow. So I will, share this story with anybody if it brings us additional attention to keep the story alive, but also if it brings us additional resources for our children.
As time moves on, Dr. Mona has some things she wants us to keep in mind about the Flint water issue.
Several things. So one, this was a preventable disaster that will hopefully never happen again. Number two, that we're flipping the story, that we are actively trying to build this model public health program. And it's not just the medical school. It's MSU Extension. It's MSU Education. It's MSU Nutrition. It's so many MSU, the water folks. It's so many parts of MSU that are committed to this, in addition to our obviously our community partners and our governmental partners. And number three, that there's hope, so that Flint has been through so much. There's so much pride and resilience in this community. We put the world on wheels here in Flint. We were the birthplace of unions. And this is a community that is proud and is loyal. And like I said before, this is just going to be a speed bump for us, and it's going to make, hopefully, you know, our future even stronger.
Hannah Atisha is encouraged by the medical student she teaches and says they'll be ideally suited to help in Flint and bring this hope to life.
They're awesome. I can't imagine not working with learners, and our Flint medical students are special. They are here because they want to be here. They live in the city of Flint. This is their community. They're always volunteering. They want to make a difference. Specifically, Flint medical school here has a program called the Leadership for the Medically Underserved. It's the LMU program. So these are medical students that want to work in underserved communities, and they come here to garner additional leadership skills to work in underserved communities. So I have a medical student who's been with me for the last couple months, and he's doing a rotation with me all about how to build leadership capacity, how to advocate, how to merge kind of public health and primary care. So the medical students are altruistic. They want to make a difference. And most medical students always have been. You go into medicine because you want to help people. But research shows as you go through your training, as you become a physician, you get jaded. You lose focus of why you really went into medicine. But opportunities like this, being involved in initiatives like this, really refocus people on why they initially went into medicine. Because it's not, you know, we get consumed with electronic medical records and billing and coding and our day-to-day work as a clinician. But be able to step back and to realize that, hey, I have a very credible voice as a physician, and this is what I was trained to do, to use my voice, especially in underserved communities. That's really what the MSU, especially the Flint campus, is all about.
And if she was made czar of medical education, Dr. Mona would like to see the pediatrics progressive mindset spread to other disciplines.
You know, pediatrics is quite progressive. We train physicians, we train our residents and our students to be advocates. We actually, before all this, I directed an advocacy rotation. Like, that is what we train our physicians for. So I think in pediatrics, we do a good job training future doctors to use their voice, to be credible in their communities, to be the voice, especially for those who are largely voiceless. But I think that philosophy needs to spread to other disciplines, you know, adult medicine and surgical specialties, because in all of those specialties, there are population health problems. And I think physicians often lose sight of their role in their community and the incredible power they have. And credibility to make a difference.
MSU has a long presence in Flint, says Dr. Mona.
The foundation was already here to do the work that we have done and that we will continue to do. So Michigan State University, especially Extension, has been here over 100 years. The medical school has been here over 40 years. Our public health programming has been here several years. And this is not a typical school of public health. This is a public health program that was created based on community needs. So this is a community that has been researched. They have been studied. And this is not what our public health work is doing here. Our public health work here is applied. It is intervention work based on what the community wants us to do. We are here to bring solutions. And that was kind of what was in the creation of it a few years ago. It took, you know, a decade to plan. But our work that we're doing now is kind of the return on that investment. So we were, you know, we were invested in trying to come up with solutions to be in the community, to be working with the community, to be addressing public health issues. And it was a perfectly placed initiative to do our work. I came to Flint, you know, 5-6 years ago. I came back to Flint because of the merger of public health in the city of Flint. Like I said, Flint is rattled with all these disparities, and we needed the leadership and the expertise for individuals to come here and to work on these issues. And that's why I came back. You know, my real job is as a residency director. So I train medical students. I train future pediatricians. But we train them to espouse the concepts of primary care and public health. So often we live in silos. You know, we practice medicine every day. We give antibiotics. We take care of one kid at a time. But we can't do that because that's not how we make the biggest difference. And I think we understand it most in pediatrics because everything we do is prevention. We give give immunizations. We tell people to wear their helmet and to eat healthy. But to be able to do that at a population health level, to be able to speak with legislators and pass immunization reform or gun control or to do things at a broader level affects more people. And that's what the MSU Public Health Program is about, is to be able to make that change at a broader, more population health level.
It was that very land-grant spirit that led Hannah Atisha to choose MSU for her own medical education.
So there really was no other option. I mean, MSU is about community-based pediatrics. MSU's focus is primary care. MSU has this biopsychosocial approach, which they walk the talk. A lot of other places say they do that, but MSU actually does that. So being in a medical school where you spend your last 2 years, your clinical years, in a community-based campus is what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to an inner-city underserved area. And I came to Flint about 20 years ago. This is where I was as a medical student. And this is where I chose to be. It's a place where you can truly make a difference in your community. And that's what MSU is all about. The mission of the medical school is service to people. And that is what they do.
To keep that land-grant spirit alive, Dr. Hannah Atisha reminds us all, appropriate investment in higher education is crucial.
As a land-grant university, being in the communities, being all over Michigan for so long, we have the trust of the community. So it was two researchers from land-grant universities, myself at Michigan State, Hurley, and then Dr. Edwards from Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech is also a land-grant university that brought this to light. So investment in university is important. So every year we see funding cuts to our higher institutions. So we need higher institutions who are in the community every day, caring for patients, working with the community, to have the resources they need to work on these issues. We have the academic freedom to do that. And we also serve as the checks and balances to governmental agencies.
When you talk with Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, hope is a word you hear often.
Yeah, so I'm very hopeful. You know, sometimes you need a disaster to bring communities together and to see a light at the end of the tunnel. And I've never seen our community more together than they are now. So if you talk to our mayor, if you talk to our legislative leaders, our community leaders, underneath the obvious trauma of this 2 years, there is hope. There are flickers of hope. And I am here to inspire that hope, to continue that message of hope, because we have to be hopeful. There is no option. These are not throwaway children. This is not a throwaway city. We have to reinvest in them. And, you know, Michigan State University, Hurley Children's Hospital, we've been here over 100 years. This is our recommitment to the community, to these children, for a brighter tomorrow. And we really have this unique situation to flip the story, to build this model public health program. And I'm hopeful that our kids will have a brighter tomorrow than even their yesterday was.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is Spartans Will.
WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. What happens when desire or circumstance puts you outside of your comfort zone and into that terrifying position where you must re-envision your future? Press reset. Colleen and I got new phones this week. After many years as iPhone people, we are moving to the Samsung Galaxy 5. It's a different ecosystem, and we're rebuilding our application suite from scratch. It's been a sometimes frustrating, ultimately enlightening experience. Our phone desktops now look totally different. We've recreated some of the familiar, but have also discovered new and better ways to leverage our smartphones to best serve our needs.
The environment is always in flux. Disruptors are everywhere. What happens if you're an iPhone and your customer decides to switch to an Android? Here's a fact of life. If your job isn't at risk now, it likely soon will be. What happens if you are forced to press the reset button? Well, first and foremost, keep calm. This is the natural progression of life. We are meant to periodically shed our cocoon and spread new wings. Keep breathing, keep centered, and look past the fear and into the realm of opportunity. Take stock of your skill portfolio. It's likely that you already have a strong career toolbox in place. What are your strengths? In your current position, what do you perceive as your liabilities? Take the broad view. How could your skill set be deployed in an emerging industry? Imagine someone approaching you with a job offer in a new innovative company. How could you become an asset? Put your ego into the box. Your body of work, no matter how extensive, may or may not help you when you press the reset button. Hold your temper if someone in a position of power doesn't appreciate all that you have to offer, gives you a cubicle instead of the office you used to have, takes away your company car, or makes you pay for your own cell phone. Look at it from the company's point of view, and you may be able to figure out how to get what you need by helping them get what they need. Sharpen your saw. Stephen R. Covey's seventh habit of highly successful people is something you should always be doing. Learn a new skill. Figure out how to be more productive, more effective, more useful. Keep learning how to become the best in the world at what you do. Create a new desktop. Now is the time to look over your behaviors and habits. Are there things that no longer serve their purpose? Revisit the timeless behaviors common to all successful people. Are you proactive? Are you anticipating the future state of your industry, your company? When was the last time you helped your boss innovate? What time are you getting up in the morning? What are you doing before you go to work to ensure you have a productive day? When was the last time you revisited your goals? Add value. Companies don't give out jobs, they hire solutions. Find a way to add value right now, right where you are, and do it. And finally, repeat. These activities, when repeated over and over, invariably generate wealth. Keep applying them. Your future vision will become clearer, and you will be able to capitalize on new horizons. Remember, no matter how secure you may feel in your current position, there is one truth you can always count on. Things will change.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.